Greetings, Tacoma. John Doherty here once again with KTAH 101.9's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate and always respectfully. And I'm going to talk about respect a little bit later on in the program. Today, we're going to be revisiting the COVID pandemic in terms of lessons learned, illustrations of how we do things politically that we can apply to climate change as we ponder that problem. One of the prominent differences is that COVID is fast moving, which makes it easier for us to see. Another thing that's different about COVID is that national boundaries do make a difference. We can look at countries like New Zealand, Taiwan, South Korea, Argentina. They've done pretty much a terrific job of managing COVID. They've done that within their own boundaries. Climate change is no respecter of borders or boundaries or any other kind of human wall to keep things out. But after looking at those two major differences, things start looking very similar. So let's kind of go down the list of some of them, once again with the idea being that we're looking for lessons learned in terms of addressing climate change. So we knew that COVID was coming. There were books written about it. There had been pandemics before. It was just a matter of time until the next pandemic was going to hit. Yet we didn't prepare. In fact, we kind of did the opposite of preparing in some ways by disbanding organizations that were intended to be a part of a COVID response. Same thing is true of climate change. We know what to do. Things like require masks, accurate testing, fast testing, contact tracing, wear masks. Yet actually, we're not even doing those things as fast moving as COVID is. And as obvious as those things are, I heard a Dr. Sanjay Gupta recently on the news making the point that only 59% of people are wearing masks where they're required or at least recommended. So that means that 40% of our population doesn't think that's worth doing, even though the evidence is clear that it is. Looking further, one of the major things that I see as a lesson from COVID is the confusion that can exist between science, physical reality, and the world of politics or personal preferences. Such things as individual freedom versus security, and a person can give too much weight to one or the other based on what their personal opinions are, and the results are not good if those opinions are in conflict with the nature of physical reality. A friend recently showed me a bumper sticker that said, "Don't believe everything you think." The short message in that is our opinions and beliefs aren't facts. They don't matter to COVID or to the physics of climate change either. Another thing that we see that's precautionary is that both COVID and climate change affect people with limited resources more so than the better off. I'm not that much up to speed with the reasons that low-income communities are more affected by COVID than better-off communities, but I am when it comes to climate change. It's real simple. Low-income people tend to live closer to sources of pollution like freeways and industry, and as a result, they suffer health effects and premature deaths out of proportion to the rest of the population. One of the things also I see is that we can identify characteristics of ourselves as human beings, things like optimism bias and confirmation bias, membership in an affinity group, and so on. But all of these qualities affect us in terms of our group decisions too, our national decisions. And in a sense, qualities become exacerbated as the numbers of people adhering to that point of view increase. And one of the other very interesting things that I see similar from COVID to climate change is with COVID, we're dealing with a little tiny virus that we can't see with the naked eye, kind of an invisible enemy. And the same thing exactly is true about CO2 emissions and the pollution they cause. A little tiny molecule that's completely invisible to us. I really believe if we could see people's breath or if we could see carbon dioxide being emitted, we wouldn't be anywhere quite so sanguine about dealing with it. So let's talk about economic damage for a minute. The high-speed problem of the COVID pandemic is making the economic damage exceedingly obvious to us. It's huge and it's going to be around for several years more than likely. We can see that. The problem with the economic damage from climate change is that it's happening slowly enough in most cases that we can't see it. But unlike the COVID damage, the damage from climate change is going to be with us for decades. It's not going to affect everybody the same. Some people are going to feel more of the pain than others, but it's going to go on. And in a certain sense, even if we're not directly affected, we are going to be affected. No man lives on an island, as the expression goes. In terms of damage over time, keep in mind one important thing, and that is we keep adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. The concentrations get stronger and stronger. Think of yourself being in a bed with too many blankets on it, and it's warm enough that you're uncomfortable with so many blankets, and somebody keeps putting on more blankets, and you get more and more uncomfortable, of course. Well, the situation is nobody's talking about taking blankets off, as in removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Our first task is to just stop adding more carbon dioxide or adding more blankets, and we are incapable of even doing that, at least so far. Another parallel I see with COVID is this notion of finger pointing. There's a real temptation to identify other people as the problem with the pandemic, the Chinese or the fruit workers over in Yakima or whoever it might be. The reality is it doesn't matter whose fault it is, or if that's even a reasonable question to ask. We have the problem, and we have to take appropriate steps to deal with the problem. Finger pointing in the terms of climate change is really massive. So as prime polluters on the face of the earth, we in America have large portions of our population who like to point the finger at China and India, who over time and at per capita produced far less fossil fuel pollution than we have. The argument becomes something like, well, unless they're going to do something about it, what's the point of us doing something about it? So finger pointing, a major problem and a major barrier to a solution to either COVID or to climate change. I made reference a couple minutes ago to our biases showing up as we approach COVID, just as they do. These biases lead to polarization, and polarization leads to gridlock. And we also start having something that I'll call micro gridlock, for lack of a better term. And that is, even folks who are environmentally concerned and want to do something about the impending climate crisis end up arguing more with like-minded groups about what to do rather than joining together and doing something. And another issue is how strongly our political perspectives can influence our opinion on what should be done about problems. I have a high school classmate I communicate with over Facebook, and he is an advocate for hydroxychloroquine as a cure for COVID, and he'll be posting stuff on Facebook the whole time. So the genesis of that, generally speaking, he's opposed, dramatically opposed to anything left of center in terms of policies and objectives. He sees that the steps that some other countries have taken to effectively deal with COVID are in conflict with his political opinion, so therefore he starts seeking out data, ideas, perspectives that allow him to cling to his political perspective and at the same time deny the reality of either COVID or climate change. Well, all those comparisons are pretty gloomy, I got to admit that, but to quote Rumi, this is not a caravan of despair, so instead of wallowing in our concerns and worries, let's take a look at what we're going to do. First of all, the story on climate change is not a binary one. It's not yes or no. It's not we either address it or we don't address it. The question is, how bad is it going to be, or how good is it going to be? And we can influence that. Absolutely, we can influence that. We can influence it with our personal behavior. I think that's a very small piece. Everybody recognizes that, but it's an influence, and it influences others, and it helps us to see the environment more clearly. I'll publish a link to some notes for today's show at the end of the program here today. I have a paper there, 100 and some ways that you can reduce your carbon footprint. You want to take a look at that? It'll give you some ideas. But really, the biggest thing we can do is to be politically active, and I'm going to hit that one a little more later on in the program. I do think that personally we want to consider mitigation and adaptation regarding climate change. I'm talking about on an individual level. the likelihood is that things are going to get significantly worse over time in terms of the climate, not better. That's not to say that we aren't going to get a handle on it eventually, but it's going to be a while. It's going to be decades before we get there. And by the way, I'm kind of hoping that we get some kind of inspired leadership along the way, somebody who's a Lincoln or a Gandhi or a Martin Luther King or a Winston Churchill, somebody who can get us all pulling pretty much in the same direction, stop squabbling with each other, and address this super critical problem. But until that happens, we do have our own individual lives, and I think it's appropriate to think about measures that we can take with our families and our loved ones, looking to the future, things like where we're going to live, what kind of educations we're going to get, what kind of political activities we're going to do, what kind of organizations we belong to. I also think that we can be diplomats for a better way of communicating between people who disagree with each other. I like to quote Stephen Covey, the Seven Habits guy. One of his principles was, seek first to understand, then to be understood. This is an ongoing project for me. Sometimes I can do it, sometimes I can't. But when I do it, I almost universally have a good result. It's so impressive to see the change of expression, the change of body language when I'm talking to somebody who understands that we disagree on something, and I can at least show them that I understand their point. And just to be clear here, there's a difference between understanding and agreement, but understanding is a great first step. So here's how it works. Somebody makes some statement about climate change that you believe to be wrong and possibly destructive. Instead of starting out with a rebuttal and explaining why it's wrong or destructive, start off by saying, okay, I want to make sure I understand what you're saying here, so this is what I'm hearing you're saying. Is that correct? And if the person can say yes, it's like job done, then perhaps you can start looking for some common ground somewhere. If the person says no, that's not it, then you keep trying until you know. In a really mature conversation, the other person will be able to do the same with you, but that doesn't happen a lot, at least in my experience. But just doing the first half is a big step forward, and it may be setting the stage for an understanding conversation further downstream. At least you've defused the whole me versus you headbutting syndrome that we're so accustomed to. Related to this is a quote, I believe it's from Socrates, but I've never been able to nail that down. The quote is, man is most convinced by that which he discovers for himself. So arguing with somebody is not a way to get people to understand things. It's more in open dialogue and understanding, asking questions and seeking out areas of common agreement. As I've kept saying, I do think the most important thing is to be politically active. And this is just not my opinion. There's a lot of good data to support the fact that political activity does make a difference. Particularly, there's a Professor Erica Chenoweth at Harvard University, and her research has shown that it only takes about 3.5% of the population, devoted, hardworking people, to bring about significant cultural, political change in a society. So it's within reach. 3.5%, that's not a lot. Okay, enough on that. I wanted to mention briefly that you probably know that I am an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby and Citizens Climate Education. And I'm pleased to announce that on July 27, Citizens Climate Lobby, Citizens Climate Education received a Keeling Curve Prize. Not just an attaboy, but a $25,000 prize. And the prize goes to organizations working on solutions to skyrocketing greenhouse gas emissions. And just a quick primer on the Keeling Curve. It's actually a chart. The chart is the chart of carbon dioxide atmospheric concentrations. It's taken at the top of Mauna Loa Observatory by the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. They take measurements every day of carbon dioxide concentrations. They've been doing that for a number of years, so that's how we know that every year the concentration of carbon dioxide is higher than the year before. Scripps, by the way, is an outfit that you'd get some fun out of checking out. I'll put a link to that also in the show notes. They have an incredible program in oceanography with research, with education. They have a fleet of ships that they're doing research all over the world. What a fantastic organization. And the Mauna Loa Observatory is just one of the many things they do. So what is the work that CCL is doing that warranted this prize? Well, it's basically advocating and educating about climate, a little bit like the kind of stuff I'm doing right now, and advocating for political change, and in particular, a carbon fee and dividend law that would put a price on carbon and give cash back to the populace, the cash that was collected from the carbon fee. Citizens Climate Lobby has been active in promoting a bill that's in Congress right now. It's H.R. 763, if you care to look it up, and it's co-sponsored by our representatives Derek Kilmer and Denny Heck. It's also co-sponsored by some Republican support, so it's intended to be and is nonpartisan, or I should say bipartisan, bill. Right now, that bill has over 80 co-sponsors, so check it out. You can find the show notes at ccltacoma.org. Just look for Climate Talk, and you'll find them on that page. I would love to hear from you. You can email me at john@ccltacoma.org, and I'll get back to you, and if appropriate, put your comments on the air. That's it for today. As always, I'm reminding you to live like the mountain is out. Take care now.